But it wasn't easy to keep selling tickets to see two guys repeat the same motion over and over again for a week. And eventually, long-distance loping was pushed aside by more action-packed, bleacher-friendly games like football. Until, in 1982, an exhausted college student named Julie Moss fell to her knees and changed everything. Julie was on the verge of winning her first Ironman when she collapsed a few yards shy of the tape. Another woman passed her, but Julie kept crawling. Instantly, an anthem was born. Just finishing is winning. Julie the Unbreakable arrived right when America needed her most. She showed she had the sand to stick it out when most of us were wondering, privately, how many of us did. The 70s had left a raw nerve in the national psyche. Had we betrayed Plymouth Rock and Valley Forge and turned into a nation of quitters? The evidence was pretty depressing. In quick succession, we'd watch Richard Nixon cheat his way to an easy win, then cut and run rather than face the music.
I would have preferred to carry through to the finish, whatever the personal agony it would have involved. My family unanimously urged me to do so, Nixon said, right before skedaddling.
We scrambled onto a rooftop helicopter to get out of Vietnam, while the Viet Cong stuck it out in the jungle. Then cringed as Jimmy Carter wobbled in the face of the Ayatollah's stony resolve during the Iran hostage crisis, and fainted less than halfway into a 6-mile fun run. If you get in it, Press Secretary Jody Powell had warned the president before the race, then you'd darn well better finish. Well, no wonder go the distance, as Rocky Balboa put it, became the message of the 70s. You didn't have to win, the Italian stallion declared. You just had to not wimp out. That was 1976, and it was as if a bat signal had flashed across the sky. Within a few years, all kinds of strange, not-wimping-out events had popped up, like Alaska's 1,112-mile Iditarod, California's 100-mile Western States Trail Race, and Hawaii's Ironman Triathlon, dreamed up, not coincidentally, by Navy officers just 3 years out of Vietnam. At first, these contests were treated as battles of the freaks, until Julie Moss, 24 years old, still in college, and one of us, jolted our eyes from the winners in the front of the pack toward the heroes in the back. TV was soon zooming in to cover these gritty everymen, as well as a new creation by Fred LeBeau, the master showman who started the New York City Marathon. On July 4th, 1983, LeBeau revived the 6-day race and soon made a star out of a Queens College instructor named Stu Middleman. A few years earlier, Stu was in Boulder, Colorado for New Year's when he decided to see if he could run to the top of Flagstaff Mountain. It was only about a 2-mile climb, but he was so psyched when he reached the peak that he turned around and ran right back down to the center of town and into Frank Shorter's running store. "How do I get into this year's Boston Marathon?" he asked. "You don't," he was told. The race was in less than 4 months, and he'd first have to qualify by running another marathon in under 3 hours. Fine. 2 weeks later, Stu averaged a smoking 6:20 a mile to finish San Diego's Mission Bay Marathon in 2 hours and 46 minutes. Raw speed he obviously had, but as he began to experiment with longer distances, he discovered his true talent was staying power. Soon he was cranking out more than a half marathon a day, 7 days a week, and leaving the standard Ironman behind to take on twice the distance. Nearly 5 miles in the water, 224 by bike, and 52 and change on foot. But damn, that right foot. Just when he was reaching his peak, a sore spot behind Stu's little toe kept swelling until it was big as a ping-pong ball and made his entire leg throb like an abscessed tooth. Stu was supposed to be boarding a flight for France in a few weeks for another 6-day race, this time as the only American invited to a showdown of international all-stars. But after shuffling from one specialist to another, his foot wasn't any better. Stu's last tune-up before the event was a triathlon in Long Island. He postponed the inevitable as long as he could, and even showed up at registration. But he finally had to limp up to the race director and break the news that he was bowing out. "Please," the race director pleaded, "first do me a favor. Long Island triathlons don't get many TV sensations in their lineups, least of all model handsome men of steel, fresh off the Today Show, and a week-long spot on Nightline. Before you make up your mind," the race director urged, "see Dr. Phil Maffetone." Stu sighed. "I have already seen nearly a dozen medical doctors, chiropractors, and body workers, and have basically given up hope that my injury can be healed," he thought. Still, he decided to humor the guy and hear what Dr. Phil had to say. That way, at least, he could drop out with a clear conscience while satisfying his own curiosity. For some time, he'd been hearing stories that were too good to be true about this healer of last resort, who not only fixed the unfixable, but coaxed astonishing performances out of slumping runners and triathletes. Phil has a reputation for getting broken-down, overtrained, world-class athletes back up and running, Stu would recall. Luckily, Dr. Phil Maffetone was right at hand. He'd come to watch one of his reconstruction projects compete, and he agreed to take a look at Stu right there on the lawn outside the VFW hall. As they chatted, Stu discovered Phil wasn't even an MD. He was a chiropractor with such severe attention deficiency that he'd barely squeaked through high school and still couldn't stand to read books. Granted, Phil was a former track athlete, but otherwise there was no outward reason he should know anything other doctors didn't. Maybe Stu's friends were only impressed because Phil treated them like real patients and not high-functioning psychotics. Phil didn't lecture them that "all that pounding is bad for the body," or answer with a shrug and "what do you expect" when they described how their heels ached after a 2-hour run. Phil wasn't shocked by big miles and didn't smirk at the adventurers who tackled them. As far as he was concerned, a properly fueled and maintained body could click along forever. He took their pain and their potential seriously. Phil had Stu lie down on the grass. He began pushing Stu's arms and legs to assess muscle resistance. "Relax," he said. He grasped Stu's foot and gave it a yank. Angels sang. "Suddenly," Stu says, "the lump disappears." He can't believe it. He jogs around gingerly, and for the first time in months, he can run without pain. He's so thrilled, he gets stupid. Instead of playing it safe and seeing if the miracle lasts until lunch, Stu decides to jump right into the triathlon. He storms along to a top 20 finish, and his foot feels fantastic. "This is just first aid," Phil warns him. He'd found a dislodged bone in Stu's foot and managed to snap it into place, but worse breakdowns lay ahead unless Stu made some serious changes. Stu was all ears. "Sure. What's my problem? Running technique? Weak arches?" "Sugar."
Really?
"And not only sweets and sodas," Phil explained. "Pasta, power bars, pancakes, pizza, orange juice, rice, bread, cereal, granola, oatmeal. All the processed carbohydrates that Stu had been told were the ideal runner's diet." "They're just sugar in disguise," Phil believed. "Humans are superb endurance athletes who've roamed farther across this planet than any other species. And we didn't do it on Gatorade and bagels. We did it by relying on a much richer and cleaner burning fuel. Our own body fat. The point of your training isn't to see how fast you can get your feet to move," Phil said. "The point is to get your body to change the way it gets energy. You want it to burn more fat and less sugar." And as it stood now, Stu's body was a sugar-burning, fat-storing monstrosity. Stu was baffled. "Okay, but how does food hurt your foot?" "Think of your body as a furnace," Phil explained. "Fill it with slow-burning logs, and it will run smooth and strong for hours. But fill it with paper and gas-soaked rags, and it will burn hot, rattle the pipes, and die out until it's fed again.
That's what you did, Phil said. You shook yourself into an injury by stuffing your furnace with garbage. If you want to stay healthy and perform your best, you need to teach your body to use fat as fuel immediately. Stu saw three major difficulties. The first problem with Phil's plan, of course, was Phil. The man was, and there's no way to sugarcoat it, a stone-cold hippie. He had long hair and a dangly ponytail and used words that made Stu's stomach heave, holistic and hormones and walk before you run. Literally, walk. Phil wanted Stu to start his next race by walking. Good Lord. The second problem with Phil's plan was Stu. He had a major international championship in 3 weeks, and rule number one for all sports is don't experiment before game day. Phil wasn't even proposing an overhaul. He wanted Stu to completely reverse his diet, training, and race strategy, and do it all in less than 20 days. But the biggest problem was everyone else in the world. Everyone else in the world thought the Maffetone method was nuts. Carbs were warrior food. Everybody knew that. Stu was an academic by training, and right from the beginning, he'd made himself a student of his sport. I cut back my work hours, lived like an ascetic monk, trained like a maniac, ate only what Runner's World told me I should, and did a carbohydrate depletion followed by a carbo load in the last few days before the event. Stu would recall. So now what? Runner's World was dead wrong? All those pre-race pasta dinners were poison? Carbohydrates were hurting, not helping? The Maffetone method even defied the greatest voice of all. Dr. Tim Noakes, author of Law of Running and one of the world's most respected sports scientists. Dr. Noakes was both a medical doctor and the head of exercise and sports science research at the University of Cape Town, and so trusted an authority that he served as expedition doctor for Lewis Pugh's North Pole swim and spearheaded reforms that dramatically reduced South African rugby injuries. Moreover, Noakes was his own space monkey. By age 64, he'd run South Africa's 56-mile Comrades Ultramarathon 7 times, and had another 70 marathons under his belt. With more than 400 scientific papers and 2,000 competitive miles to his name, Noakes knew more about runners, living and dead, than the runners themselves. He'd not only written the 800-page law, but he kept rewriting it. Every few years, Noakes updated his Bible with fresh science. The best in the world listened to Dr. Tim Noakes, and Dr. Tim Noakes was all about carbs. Athletes whose training involves prolonged high-intensity daily exercise must eat high-carbohydrates diets, Noakes made it clear. Performance during prolonged exercise can potentially be enhanced by increasing the amount of carbohydrate stored before exercise, he went on, and by maintaining a high rate of carbohydrate utilization, particularly when fatigued, by ingestion of carbohydrates in the appropriate amounts. It was all right there in Chapter 3, and all those 50-plus pages on energy systems and running performance could be nicely summed up in just 7 words. Stuff in carbs and keep on stuffing. And sorry, who was Phil Maffetone again? A ponytail backcracker from suburban New York. Those were Stu's 2 options. The man who wrote the book versus the man who probably hadn't read it. Ordinarily, it would be an easy decision, but pain relief is the ultimate persuader. Stu decided to give the Maffetone method a chance. Okay, he told Phil. How do we start? Simple, Phil began. To use fat as fuel, you need to do only 2 things. Cut out sugar and lower your heart rate. We store only a very limited amount of carbohydrate in our bodies, Phil explained. Compare this with a relatively unlimited supply of fat. Carbs are a puddle. Fat is the Pacific. At any time, your body has some 160,000 calories on tap, about 2,000 from sugar,
25,000 from protein, and nearly 140,000, 87%, are fat. Even an athlete with only 6% body fat will have enough fat to fuel exercise lasting for many hours, Phil explained. When you use more fat, you generate more energy, and your carbohydrate supply lasts longer. When you teach your body to rely on fat, your combustion of carbs goes down, and so does your craving for them. But there's no pussyfooting around. Your body loves fat. It's a treasure your system would rather hoard than burn. So if it senses there's any other fuel at hand, it will use that first and convert the leftovers into more fat. To free himself from the sugar burn cycle, Stu would have to go cold turkey. He could stuff himself silly all day, but only on meat, fish, eggs, avocados, vegetables, and nuts. No beans, no fruit, no grains, no soy, no wine, no beer. Whole dairy like sour cream and real cheese were in. Low-fat milk was out. That was part one. Part two was even more basic. Slow down. When you sprint, Phil explained, you jack up your heart rate. Your body interprets a hammering heart as emergency, so it goes looking for those gas-soaked rags. It wants the fastest-burning fuel it can find, and that means sugar. But once you've conditioned your body to rely on fat, you'll be able to run as fast as ever, and much faster. For Stu to keep his heart rate in his fat-burning zone, Phil had an easy formula. Just subtract your age from 180. Stu was 32 years old, so Phil gave him a heart rate monitor and set it for 153 beats per minute. 148 plus 5 bonus beats, because Stu was a highly conditioned athlete. Anytime the monitor beeped, it meant Stu had to slow to a walk until his pulse eased back down. For 3 weeks, Stu was a perfect disciple. Come the six-day race in France, however, he'd had enough. It was humiliating enough when all the other runners shot off around the track while he trailed them at a walk. Yuck, Stu grimaced. But to watch them snacking on cookies and candy at the aid stations while he had nothing but almonds, well, that just bordered on human rights abuse. Unfortunately, Phil Maffetone had come to France with him. So Stu had to sneak cookies off the aid station table and hide them at the far end of the track, where he could munch later when Phil wasn't looking. But before digging into his stash, Stu noticed something. For once, he could actually see what was going on. Usually during a race, he was huffing along with his chin on his chest, but this time he was head high and breathing easy. Come to think of it, he'd felt that way during every run for the past 3 weeks. For most runners, enjoying the view is a rare sensation. As soon as fatigue kicks in, your eyes drop to the pavement and your vision tunnels. You're no longer in the present. You're locked on to how far you've come and how far you've got to go. Stu always assumed pain was the price of gain, but since he'd been on the Maffetone method, his runs had actually been a pleasure. Each energy-producing state has specific and real sensory-based references, he'd learned. Your body knows this by the way the world looks, sounds, and feels. When you move in a comfortable, fat-burning state, the visual information is distinct, expansive, and three-dimensional, with a peripheral vastness and expansiveness that is unique and identifiable. It's as though you are in a 3D surround vision movie theater. You're seeing with the eyes of a hunter. But when your heart rate climbs, you become the hunted. As soon as you shift into a more challenging, sugar-burning state, visual information tends to collapse inward. The peripheral fringes tend to disappear, and your attention gets drawn into a much narrower field of vision. Visual images tend to flatten out, become two-dimensional, and you begin to feel as though you are running through a tunnel with a world painted on the inside walls. So that's how hunter-gatherers run antelopes to death. They don't act like the animal they're trying to kill. Instead, they're silent and graceful, moving easily with their eyesight sharp, their breathing controlled, their bottomless body fat energy on tap. Much the way Stu was moving now, in fact, as he smoothly and stealthily pursued the runners who dropped him at the start. 3 weeks earlier, Stu had been so hobbled by injury he couldn't compete. Now, he was chasing down the best ultra-distance runners in the world and getting faster by the day. Stu felt so good that for the entire 6 days, he never dug into his cookie stash. He set a new American record of 571 miles, crushing the old one by more than a half marathon and finishing in second behind only the beast himself, 24-hour world record holder Jean-Gilles Boussiquet of France. That did it. Stu was now a fat-as-fuel true believer. For the next 10 years, he whirlwinded through the record books with such strength and style, it looked more like art than effort. In a display of virtually flawless foot racing, as one journalist put it, Stu defeated the reigning world champion in a 1,000-mile showdown and not only shattered the old mark by 16 hours, but even ran his second 500 miles faster than his first. He handled the back half of his life the same way. Instead of slowing down in his 40s, he got stronger, running more than 50 miles a day as he set a new speed record from Los Angeles to New York City. No other American ultra runner, male or female, has exhibited national class excellence at such a wide range of racing distances, his American Ultra Running Hall of Fame induction proclaimed. But the funny thing is, Stu wasn't even Phil's best student. Compared with Mark Allen, Stu was, well, there's really no comparing anyone to Mark Allen. When Mark came to Phil in the late 80s, he was in his 20s, but already feeling old. Triathlons were beating him up and not paying off. Mark was always hurt in training and blowing up in races, either fading toward the finish or dropping out altogether. Like Stu, his broken body gave him an open mind. "I was warned that his methods were probably going to sound crazy," Mark would recall, "not to mention embarrassing." Phil made Mark pedal far behind the pack during group rides and plod along at half speed during runs. Mark's training partners were convinced he was washed up, until 4 months later, when Mark went flying past. "I had become an aerobic machine. I was now able to burn fat for fuel efficiently enough to hold a pace that a year before was redlining my effort," Mark explained. "I was no longer feeling like I was ready for an injury the next run I went on, and I was feeling fresh after my workouts instead of being totally wasted." Mark soon tore off an insane streak. For 2 years, he didn't lose a race anywhere, at any distance. He won Ironman 6 times, including a stunning comeback victory at age 37. But what's more intriguing is what happened after he retired. Bikes got lighter, wetsuits got sleeker, training and nutrition became more lab-tested and sophisticated. Yet no one could touch Mark's times. It was nearly 2 decades before another Ironman could match him. "Mark Allen was well ahead of us scientists," agrees Dr. Oscar Eukendrup, a human metabolism expert at England's University of Birmingham and an accomplished Ironman himself. Eukendrup is among the top ranks of endurance specialists, yet even he's a little foggy about the role played by the quiet guy with a ponytail. So was Mike Pigg, who only tracked Phil down at Mark Allen's urging. "Phil Maffetone is not crazy," Pigg insists, which suggests he wasn't always sure himself. "I feel very fortunate to have met him when I did." After switching to the Maffetone method, Pigg won 4 USA Triathlon National Championships and remained resilient enough to compete for nearly a quarter century. Dr. George Sheehan, the cardiologist, best-selling author, and philosopher king of the marathon, also put his legs in Dr. Phil's hands. But oddly, Phil eventually began seeing more rock stars than Iron Men. An athlete has to be supremely confident or borderline desperate to gamble on a system that flips everything she's been told and guarantees she's heading straight to the back of the pack, possibly for an entire season. But rock stars don't have to deal with doubtful coaches and corporate sponsors. They just have to be strong enough to endure months of onstage musical marathons. Musicians are all searching for the same two things, Maffetone learned. How do I get more energy, and how can I become more creative? James Taylor was an early Maffetone adopter. I feel great, he'd rave. And the Red Hot Chili Peppers brought Phil on board as tour doctor. Years later, at age 50, Peppers bassist Flea could still crank out a sub-4-hour marathon in a driving rainstorm. Rick Rubin, the great bearded sage of the sound studio, tracked down Phil in 2003, when Johnny Cash was on his deathbed. Phil got Johnny back on his feet, helped restore his eyesight, and began weaning him off his astonishingly high pill count of some 40 different medications. Cash was so grateful, he gave Phil one of his guitars. But ultimately, Cash couldn't recover from the loss of his wife and the after effects of the chemical barrage. Phil had his hand on Cash's shoulder one afternoon when Cash turned and looked him in the eye. It's time, Cash said. No one saw Dr. Phil at Iron Man after that. No one saw much of him anywhere unless you were Rick Rubin. Rubin owned Shangri-La, the secluded Malibu bungalow where Bob Dylan and the band used to camp out and jam with Eric Clapton and Van Morrison, and where, for a time, TV horse Mr. Ed was stabled. Every once in a while, Phil would roll up at Shangri-La and play Rubin some songs he'd written. Then he'd climb back into his car and disappear into the Arizona desert. Phil was so out of touch, it was some time before he learned that after 30 years, he'd won both an argument and a convert. Dr. Tim Noakes, the high priest of carbo loading, was making a confession. Chapter 33. I was quite wrong. Sorry, everyone. Dr. Timothy Noakes. I was famished by the time I met Dr. Noakes in the lobby of his Washington, D.C. hotel and figured we'd head straight out to eat. It was pushing 1 p.m., and Noakes had been stuck in a conference all morning discussing, among other things, his biggest professional mistake. We just had time for a hearty lunch before his flight back home to South Africa. But Noakes had other ideas. I won't eat until tomorrow, he said, or the next day. You go 2 days without food? Or more. Sometimes I've got to stop and think to remember my last meal. Looking at him, it's hard to believe. At 64, Noakes is tall and fit as a lumberjack, with the rangy look of the college rower he once was, and the barely contained energy of a man whose mind is a constantly expanding to-do list. Everything about him seemed to demand constant refueling. His locked-in focus when listening, his Christmas morning grin when amused, the unruly brown hair barely touched by time or a comb. It would all make sense, Noakes promised, when I heard his story. He suggested we grab coffee and get right to it. He had a lot to get off his chest. It's really funny when you think how chance events occur, he begins. In 2010, Noakes was finally reaching the end of a grim crusade. Back in 1981, he suspected joggers were being tricked into drinking themselves to death. Companies like Gatorade were pushing the idea that runners needed lots of fluids to avoid dehydration, and the race directors and running magazines who depend on sponsorship and advertising were quick to join the chorus. Suddenly, you could barely run a mile in a race without someone handing you a cup. Runners were told, drink until your eyeballs float, and don't just rely on thirst. But hang on. When did thirst suddenly become unreliable? For millions of years, it's been fantastically effective. In fact, it's one of the most important aspects of our evolutionary development. Humans lived or died by their ability to lope long on hot days. And the reason we survived is that our bodies told us when and how much to drink. It was precisely because we're resistant to dehydration that we could run other animals to death. Humans evolved to be extremely adept long-distance runners with an unmatched ability to regulate their body temperatures when exercising in the heat, Noakes knew, and our brains developed the ability to delay the need to drink. A crucial adaptation if we were to chase after our potential meals in the midday heat, when there was little water available and no time to stop the hunt to search for fluid. Noakes began checking the habits of runners from the pre-Gatorade era and discovered that old-school marathoners had no trouble going dry. "I only chew gum. I take no drink at all," Matthew Maloney said after he set the marathon world record in 1908. Mike Grattan won the London Marathon in 1983 without a single sip, and Arthur Newton, the legendary ultra-runner and five-time Comrades champion, believed, "Even in the warmest English weather, a 26-mile run ought to be manageable with no more than a single drink, or, at most, two." To this day, the San people of the Kalahari can run up to 7 hours in heat of 108 degrees Fahrenheit on just a few swallows. So now, all of a sudden, the American College of Sports Medicine, with major funding by its first platinum sponsor Gatorade, was declaring thirst may be an unreliable index of fluids needed during exercise? Something else was fishy. The 56-mile Comrades race never had a problem with dehydration and heat illness before it set up regular aid stations. "This paradox did not escape me," Noakes points out. "How could dehydration and heat illness have become a significant problem in marathon and ultramarathon running after frequent drinking had become the accepted norm?" Nothing added up, least of all the corpses. When Noakes researched post-race body weights, he found something peculiar. Elite runners pump out more sweat than the mid-pack plodders. If dehydration were truly a danger, how did the elites even make it to the finish line? Logically, the faster runners should be knocked off their feet. Instead, they're stronger than everyone else in the field. And when Noakes went looking for all those marathoners who supposedly keeled over from too little to drink, he found none. Not one. Ever. There is not a single report in the medical literature of dehydration being a proven direct cause of death in a marathon runner, Noakes discovered. But if you look at runners who had plenty to drink, that's a different story. That's where the bodies turn up. In the United States, three marathoners died on days that weren't extraordinarily warm. In the UK, a fitness instructor in excellent shape and known for advising his own clients about hydration was dead soon after running the London Marathon. In the same race, a sports scientist with expertise in endurance conditioning became so delusional that she kept running in place while lying on a stretcher. Eight trekkers dropped into comas and never recovered while hiking the Kokoda Trail, a popular route for Australians on Papua New Guinea. For all of them, fluids weren't just available, they were unavoidable, just as they were at the Houston Marathon in 2000, when dozens were rushed to the medical tent, even though drinks were handed out every single mile. None of these people were fleeing for their lives. None of them were pursuing food across the savannah. So if they were slowly dying of thirst, why on earth didn't they just pick up a cup? How could they be so blind to their own doom? Shipwreck victims survive on life rafts for weeks. How did these athletes die within a few hours? Noakes was baffled. And then it hit him. They were drowning. Instead of too little to drink, they were dying from too much. They'd gulped so much fluid, they diluted their blood sodium concentration and caused their brains to swell. Water poisoning. Suddenly, it all made sense. The sports drink giants had been fantastically successful at tricking people into believing that, unlike every other creature on Earth, Humans were too stupid to know when to drink. Cows and puppies and infants have it covered, but not you. No, you need to be told. The terrible irony was that by inventing a fake health scare, the drink giants had created a real one. They'd scared people into believing they were drinking too little, and fooled them into drinking too much. It was death by marketing. Noakes found 12 confirmed deaths by water poisoning in sports events, and thousands of close calls. The science of hydration is propaganda conceived by marketers who wish to turn a collection of kitchen chemicals into a multi-billion dollar industry, Noakes declared. To their credit, they succeeded. To their unending shame, they cost the lives of some of those they were pretending to protect. The scam was so outrageous, Noakes was sure it would explode as soon as it was revealed. Instead, he found himself battling the mafia of science, as he calls it, doctors and researchers funded by corporate war chests. The more Noakes insisted the drink giants were a lethal menace, the more the drink giants and their paid PhDs blasted the message that humans were frail creatures who couldn't trust their own bodies. "Drink before you're thirsty, or you'll just be playing catch-up," the Gatorade camp insisted. "Drink before, during, and after exercise." When Oscar Eukendrup published a study that showed sports drinks are basically placebos, you can swish and spit and get the same benefit as if you'd swallowed, Gatorade knew just what to do. It hired him. As for Noakes, well, the mafia of science regretted that such a respected scientist was now just a mouthy crank. True, Noakes was possibly the world's top authority on distance running physiology, but his warnings about excess hydration were just one man's opinion. As the director of the Gatorade Sports Science Institute sniffed, and not representative of the comprehensive research that is available on the topic of hydration during exercise. Noakes persisted, gathering evidence from around the world for Waterlogged, his 400-plus page indictment of the sports drink industry. On the night he wrote the last sentence, in December 2010, he went to bed thinking, "Tomorrow, you've got to start running again." He'd been absorbed in work for too long. He hadn't run a marathon in 4 years. He'd put on 30 pounds. And he was about to wake up to a sickening discovery. His own advice about carbs was killing him. It was that first run that opened his eyes. Noakes got up as planned and huffed out a few miles, hating every step. He felt fat and slow, as if he'd never run a step before. His father and brother had both died from diabetes, and Noakes knew from his thickening waist and increasing sluggishness that he was heading in the same direction. He'd always persuaded himself that running would keep his weight under control, but now the misery of starting all over again made him face the truth. It wasn't going to work. It had never worked. "In 41 years of running, I have learnt that the numerous benefits of exercise do not include any sustained effects on weight loss," Noakes realized. Even during his peak of nearly 20 miles a day back in the 70s, he'd lost only a few pounds and yo-yoed them right back on again. His medical training told him that exercise and calorie control should do the trick. But after 4 decades as a conscientious eater and athlete, he was living proof that his medical training was wrong. With his book out of the way and his genetic time bomb ticking, Noakes set out to find out what was going on. He began digging into nutrition science with the same intensity with which he'd gone after drinks, examining the primary research behind the dietary guidelines. What he found made Noakes angry, then heartsick. He'd been duped. Even worse, the whole time he'd been so self-righteous during his holy war with the drink giants, he'd been the instrument of something even deadlier. The food industry had pulled the same trick as the drink giants. And Noakes hadn't only missed it, he'd endorsed it. For decades, he'd advocated a carbohydrate-rich diet. He was so influential, he'd been dubbed the High Priest of Carbo-Loading, and processed carbs, he now understood, were toxic. Skillful marketing has made carbohydrate consumption a religion among athletes, he'd fume. They believe that you cannot get energy from anywhere but carbs. The same foods Noakes had assured people would make them stronger and faster were a slow-acting poison, making them fatter, weaker, and more prone to heart attacks, strokes, diabetes, and dementia. Privately, Noakes was anguished for another reason. It wasn't well known, but Noakes's father had made his fortune as a tobacco broker. In medical school autopsies, Noakes had seen firsthand the kind of horror his father's profession wreaked on human bodies. He'd been troubled by Big Tobacco's stealth efforts to increase addiction and market to minors, and it gnawed at him that every time his father cut a check to pay his school fees, it was at the cost of the ill health of those who smoke cigarettes containing the tobacco he exported. In the end, Noakes's father begged him to make amends. "Tim, I did not help enough people in my life," his father told him. "You had better do so." Now Noakes discovered he'd been pushing something that was even more addictive and shopped even more shamelessly, especially to children. If he'd been more careful, if he'd been more skeptical about the mass production and marketing of processed carbs, he could have saved so many people, starting with his own brother and father. He wished he'd been aware of these four key pieces of evidence. Human history. It's an inconvenient truth, but a truth nevertheless. Animal fat made us who we are. When our ancestors first strayed from the African savanna, they weren't following the harvest, they were following the herds. They went in search of meat. And wherever they found it, no matter how harsh the environment, they stayed. For over 2 million years, we lived on the meats and chewy roots we could hunt and gather. Eggs, fatty flesh, and cheeses were prized because they were rich in energy, easy to preserve, and such a steadily burning nutrient that a few ounces could sustain someone all day. When the ancient Greeks offered the fattiest cut of meat to the gods, it was a sacrifice. They gave up what they wanted most. Only very recently did we switch to farm-raised grains, and since then we've seen a decrease in average human height and a spike in obesity and nutrition deficiency diseases. The worst explosion began in the 1980s, after the United States embarked on a disastrous experiment. From 1960 to 1980, obesity remained constant, but in 1977, the United States separated itself from every other government in history by vilifying meat and pushing grains, which were traditionally used to fatten cattle. Soon after, America's obesity rate shot up and hasn't stopped. Plumbing theory. America's shift from proteins to grains was sparked by Ansel Keys, a biochemist from the University of Minnesota, who made his name during World War II by inventing K-rations, the ready-to-eat meal for combat troops. Later, Keyes was reading his local newspaper's obituary column when he noticed an unusual number of rich Minnesotans were dropping dead of heart disease. One thing America had after the war that other nations lacked was plenty of red meat, so Keyes developed a plausible-sounding theory. If you pour bacon grease down your sink, it will thicken inside your pipes and eventually clog them. Our arteries must work the same way, Keyes assumed. Keyes hypothesized that heart disease was mostly a nutritional disorder linked directly to the amount of fat in the diet, one journalist explained. High fat foods raise cholesterol levels in the blood, which in turn increase the risk of clogged arteries and heart disease. That also sounded right to Senator George McGovern, who'd experimented with the low-fat Pritikin diet. McGovern very quickly gave up on low-fat himself, but just because he didn't want to eat that way didn't mean other people shouldn't. McGovern would go on to become an extraordinarily influential voice in nutrition, serving as the United Nations' first global envoy on world hunger, and teaming with Senator Bob Dole to create a worldwide school lunch program. So largely on the whim of one powerful senator, the fat is fatal theory was rammed through U.S. health agencies in 1977 and propelled along by governmental food faddists who hold the public in thrall, as Science magazine put it. Later, journalist Gary Torbes would reveal that Ansel Keys had built his argument on his seven-country study, ignoring data from three times as many other countries that weakened his theory. Dead people were also a problem. If Keys was right, the new U.S. dietary recommendations should have caused heart disease to plummet. Instead, it skyrocketed. In the 20 years after the fat warnings went into effect, medical procedures for heart disease quintupled from 1.2 million to 5.4 million a year. Insulin is Oz. Whether you become fatter or skinnier, stronger or weaker, more alert or lethargic, is largely influenced by insulin, the hormone that acts as your body's warehouse foreman. When sugars and carbohydrates are converted to glucose and enter your bloodstream, your pancreas deploys insulin to figure out where to store it. Glucose is great when your body needs it. It fuels brain and muscle cells and is converted into fat for future use. It also acts as tinder so your body can burn fat as fuel. But here's the catch. Insulin evolved to handle complex carbs created by nature, like leafy greens, not simple carbs created by us, like cereal and bread. Simple carbs are absorbed too fast. Your cells get their fill, and the rest is turned into fat before your insulin has a chance to dissipate. The still active insulin in your bloodstream goes looking for more sugar, which makes you feel hungry. So you chow another donut, starting the whole process all over again. Enough years of this abuse, and your cells can become insulin resistant. They're tired of being asked to absorb all this glucose, so they just stop responding. What then happens to all that glucose? It goes straight to fat. That's what killed Noakes's father and brother. Their system needed fuel it wasn't getting, while storing fat it didn't need. Fat as fuel. But there's a way out, Noakes discovered. Once you kick the carbohydrate habit, you can convert your body back into a fat burner. If you're fat adapted, Noakes posited, then theoretically you should be able to source all your energy from fat metabolism, especially during very prolonged exercise, when the intensity of the activity is somewhat lower, so that there should not be any need to burn carbohydrates. Bruce Fordyce, the legendary South African ultramarathon champ, put it to the test. Like Noakes, Fordyce had packed on the pounds since his glory days. But once he stopped eating grains and sugars and adopted a high-fat, low-carb diet, Fordyce underwent a running renaissance. At age 56, he beat his best-ever comrade's time by 2 hours and chopped 5 minutes off his 5K, improving from 7 minutes and 20 seconds a mile to 5 minutes and 40 seconds. A tremendous achievement for any experienced athlete, let alone one pushing 60. Still, Fordyce's self-experimentation is decades away from catching up with Dr. Fred Kummerow, a University of Illinois scientist who, since the 1950s, has taken the position that hardening of the arteries isn't caused by LDL, the so-called bad cholesterol found in eggs, red meat, and cheese. If LDL were deadly, Kummerow asks, then how come half of all heart disease patients have normal or low LDL levels? Something else must have killed them, and Kummerow believes it's exactly the food push by the US government, polyunsaturated vegetable oils like soybean, corn, and sunflower. Cholesterol has nothing to do with heart disease, except if it's oxidized, Dr. Kumarao told the New York Times. And because soybean and corn oils are inherently unstable, they're quick to oxidize under the high heat of frying or even normal digestion. Kumarao put his own body on the firing line. He eats LDL food daily, including red meat, eggs scrambled in butter, and a glass of whole milk every day. He's 100 years old, takes no meds, and runs his own university lab. Yes, you read that age correctly. 100. When I met up with Noakes in D.C., he'd flown all the way from Cape Town for a one-day conference on innovations in diabetes. That morning, he'd tucked away a farmhand's breakfast of eggs, sausage, and bacon. A meal like that will leave him satisfied all day, often longer. I just don't get hungry anymore, he shrugged. Sometimes I'll feel my energy waning and realize I haven't eaten in 48 hours. So basically we're talking about paleo, I ask. The paleo diet is based on the premise that humans are healthiest when they follow the example of our Stone Age ancestors and eat grass-fed meats, wild-caught fish, vegetables, nuts, and seeds, and stay away from rice, bread, pasta, and other grain-based foods from the agricultural age. Basically, yes, Noakes replies. Although for the sake of precision, he'd replace paleo with banting. Noakes can't be scientifically certain about what early humans ate, but he knows exactly what was on the menu of an overweight London embalmer named William Banting. Back in the 1860s, Banting was England's undertaker to the stars, and so sought after that he was given the honour of building the coffin for the Duke of Wellington, one of Britain's most beloved heroes. Banting's success, however, was pushing him toward his own grave. He attended so many lavish funeral dinners that by age 66 he was nearly spherical. He was only 5'5", yet weighed over 200 pounds, and was so belly heavy he had to walk downstairs backwards and couldn't tie his own shoes. Banting's doctors prescribed every known treatment for obesity. Diets, Turkish baths, heavy exercise, spa retreats, even systematic vomiting. But every pound he took off boomeranged right back on again. Oddly, Banting made a breakthrough only when he began going deaf. He went to see a hearing specialist named William Harvey, who decided Banting's problem wasn't his ears, but his waistline. Poor circulation was damaging his auditory canal, so in August, Banting began following Dr. Harvey's eating instructions. Breakfast. 5 or 6 ounces of beef, mutton, kidneys, broiled fish, bacon, or cold meat of any kind, except pork. 1 small biscuit or 1 ounce of dry toast. A large cup of tea without milk or sugar. Lunch. 5 or 6 ounces of any fish except salmon, any meat except pork, and any vegetable except potato. Any kind of poultry or game. 1 ounce of dry toast. 2 or 3 glasses of good claret, sherry, or Madeira. Dinner. 3 or 4 ounces of meat or fish as for lunch. A glass of claret or 2. Nightcap, if required. So morning, noon, and night, Banting was feasting on roasts and fatty steaks with sides of buttery broccoli and washing it down with tasty wines, plus a snort of gin before bed. He was packing in the calories too. Banting's meals amounted to nearly 3,000 calories a day, triple what most weight loss diets allow. Yet even in his mid-60s, when weight loss is most difficult, Banting trimmed off 20 pounds in the first 5 months. Within a year, he'd reduced his weight by 50 pounds and his waist by 12 inches, and he remained trim the rest of his life. The Banting plan was the foundation of the Atkins diet in the 1970s, Noakes explains. We keep rediscovering these same fundamental principles of nutrition, then we forget them and start all over again. In 2012, the Los Angeles Lakers began following in Banting's footsteps after a nutritionist consulting for the team became concerned about Dwight Howard, the superstar center nicknamed Superman for his Adonis abs and cannonball biceps. Howard was only 27 years old and looked fantastic, with only 6% body fat, but there was something a little off about his hands. It looked like he was wearing oven mitts, the nutritionist would recall. It reminded me of patients who have pre-diabetes and neurological problems because of how sugar impacts the nervous system. A blood screening revealed Howard's glucose level was through the roof, and a nutritional assessment found he was basically living on sugar. Between candy, soda, and starches, he was downing the equivalent of 24 chocolate bars a day. So the entire Lakers squad, including franchise player Kobe Bryant and seasoned veteran Steve Nash, joined Howard in a Banting-style meal makeover. Not only are the Lakers unafraid of healthy fats, they practically freebase them, one journalist noted. The pre-game beverage of choice is something the players call bulletproof coffee. Coffee seasoned with 2 teaspoons of pastured butter and heavy grass-fed cream. I've seen great results from it, from when I started doing it last year. Watching your sugar intake, making sure you're eating healthy fats, Kobe Bryant was quoted. You've got to find a balance in that system. It's worked well for me. Lakers forward Sean Williams showed up 20 pounds overweight for training camp. By doubling his fat intake and cutting out sugar, he took off 25. Now most Lakers' meals are built around grass-fed beef, humanely raised pork, raw nuts, squeeze packs of hazelnut butter, kale chips, and grass-fed beef jerky. Dwight Howard even remained faithful after he was traded. When he arrived in Houston, Howard persuaded Rockets management to start Banting. "We had to make that change," Rockets general manager Daryl Morey told a reporter. "And I should have pushed harder earlier." For Dr. Noakes, it's been a 3-year journey of scientific awakening and personal transformation. He's back down to 175 pounds, same as he was in his 20s, and feels like an athlete again. 8 weeks after he stopped eating sugar and processed carbs, Noakes was in Stockholm for a conference. It was dark when he arrived, and 25 degrees below freezing, but Noakes went on a 5-mile run anyway. He slept a few hours, then got up and ran 10 more. "A few weeks earlier, I could barely finish 5K, he recalls. "I thought it was aging, but it was really carbohydrate intolerance. In 2 months, I lost 11 kilos. I turned it all around." "We've been brainwashed into being repulsed by the mention of the word fat," Noakes says. "But the real heart danger is sugar. It's a corrosive that damages arterial walls, creating grooves that allow plaque to adhere. Which means the only real solution for cardiovascular disease and global obesity," Noakes feels, "is pure scorched earth. 10 companies produce 80% of processed foods in the world, and they're creating billions and billions of dollars in profits by poisoning people," he says. "I'd tax them out of existence. If you don't take addictive foods out of the environment, you'll never cure the addiction." Some of Noakes's fellow scientists think he's going too far. The Heart Association was quick to urge caution. The same day Noakes began advocating saturated fats, the Heart Association issued a warning that the Noakes diet is dangerous. It was an impressive performance, Noakes felt. Cramming 3 mistakes into 4 words in 1 day isn't easy. It's not his, he argues, since it's been the basis of human nutrition for more than 2 million years. It's not a diet, because there are no portion or calorie restrictions. And how can it possibly be dangerous when humans have thrived on those very foods for most of our existence? If it were dangerous, we'd be extinct. Rather than going too far, Noakes is furious with himself for starting so late. Back when he first began to suspect he'd been wrong about carbs, Noakes dug into the data on Iron Man legend Mark Allen. Allen's eating habits were well documented. Noakes could find almost no starches or processed carbs in the mix.